This is Alton Banks from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So this week's Triangle Business Journal program is going to be a little different in the sense that I'm completing some of the work from last week's Triangle Business Journal that was just too long to fit into the program. And we're going to finish the work on the Amazon effect, and then we'll switch over to this week's Triangle Business Journal. And so a couple of short articles here from last week on the list. And the list for that week talks about the companies that operate in a number of fields, including healthcare, technology, and manufacturing. But which industries are most represented on the list? And I thought you might like to know, these are the 50 top ones, and I'll simply read the major area and the number of businesses in that area for the top 50 companies. So life sciences comprises 3, education 2, healthcare 5, manufacturing 7, financial services 2, construction 10, technology 4, retail and food service 6, nonprofits 1, logistics and transportation 2, specialty services 4, hospitality and real estate 3, and then utilities 1. And also on this pie chart that's shown is the question, where are you working from? While the majority of the employers on this year's list are located in Raleigh, there are 10 other cities and towns in the Triangle that are represented. So below this big pie chart is a bar graph that shows where most people are working from. And so once again, out of 50, 28 are working from Raleigh and 8 from Durham. Those numbers aren't surprising. 5 from Cary, 2 from RTP, 1 from Morrisville and 1 from Chapel Hill, and 1 each from Dunn, Fuquay Varina, Hillsboro, Sanford, and Rocky Mount. And in an extra to the list are a few facts about some of the companies that you might not have known. Just a couple of blurblets here. One on Concord Hospitality Enterprises. Concord's portfolio spans nearly 20 states and 2 countries and includes more than 100 properties. Fortune and consulting firm Great Place to Work announced in September that the company was named one of the country's 100 best workplaces for women in 2017. This was the second consecutive year on the list. Also, SAS. Cary-based SAS nabbed the number one ranking on Grant Thornton's 2017 list of top 100 private companies in North Carolina. It was one of only 3 companies on the list that had $1 billion or more in fiscal year revenue. The company Kimley Horn. National planning and design consulting firm Kimley Horn expanded its overall headcount by more than 200 from last year. Its revenue also went up from $628 million to $722 million. SunState Security. The Raleigh-based SunState Security is majority female-owned and is the largest female-owned company in the Triangle by employee size. The company was founded in 1998. Mutual Distributing Company. Raleigh's Mutual Distributing holds the record for the most appearances on the Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 list, more than 20 times. And finally, in this extra piece, Trial Card. Currently sitting at just north of 400 employees company-wide, Morrisville-based Trial Card says it expects to expand that headcount to 600 by the end of 2017. And next year, the company plans to hire an additional 250 people. And as a lead-in to this week's issue on Amazon, comes a graph, small pie chart, on the ACBJ Business Survey Pulse. And the question offered is this. Do you want your city or state to offer financial incentives to Amazon to land its new HQ2? Now, there were 2,257 responses to this, and of those, 75% said yes, with a balance of 25% saying no. Now, a quick reminder about the Amazon Effect project. For the past 9 months, the business journals and its 40 newsrooms have made a concerted effort to document the systematic expansion of Amazon.com, Inc., from Class A office spaces in the nation's largest cities to former cornfields and barren industrial spaces long abandoned by industries of old. The company's growth, while massive in scope, has hinged on negotiations with local officials, deals with local real estate developers, and tax breaks blessed by local municipalities. In short, it's all local. This project is both near-term and forward-looking in scope, and sets off to identify where the Seattle-based company's unrelenting expansion might be headed. It's as much about Amazon's endgame as a business entity as it is about the long-lasting effect it's likely to have on America for decades to come. And with this description come four large pictures and some captions. And so here are the captions, one showing the picture of the Amazon headquarters. And it's a tale of two companies. Amazon often is credited for supporting high-paying jobs and some of the most modern and expensive real estate spaces in the country. Less heralded is its other tendency, often in nearby locations, to offer low-paying warehouse jobs as it aggressively pursues taxpayer subsidies. One of these pictures is called The Savior. Amazon's expansion throughout the United States has resulted in the creation of hundreds of thousands of jobs and the revitalization of dormant industrial spaces and land parcels. It's no wonder that economic development officials in cities from Jacksonville, Florida, to Santa Cruz, California, have put the company on notice. We're open for business. The third picture is of a construction device digging big trenches in pasture land. And this is called The One That Got Away. Expansive logistics hubs, great infrastructure, strategic locations, and yet no Amazon. As the company grows, so too does the list of U.S. cities left scratching their heads over a simple question. Why has Amazon forsaken us? The answer, more often than not, has nothing to do with a willingness to play ball. And finally, the fourth picture is entitled The Disruptor. In just over 30 years, Amazon has evolved from an online bookstore into an e-commerce giant capable of shipping everything from car tires to baby diapers. Entire industries, groceries, broadcasting, consumer staples, and furniture, to name a few, can attest to the company's strategic disruption, as can many of the nation's once dominant employers that now rest in Amazon's wake. Now we dive into the major headings of the Amazon effect, and there are three large articles here. And the first one is called A $1 Billion Power Play. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has built a net worth of roughly $85 billion with a sort of discipline and scale refined by corporate titans before him, Rockefeller, Ford, and Gates among them, though no one has so efficiently tapped America's collective impatience and love for a bargain. What Albuquerque's favorite son is accomplishing, and the ruthless speed at which he is accomplishing it, is unprecedented. He's had lots of help along the way. Americans have supported the Bezos surge in two distinct ways, by buying everything from dog food to diamonds on Amazon.com, and by kicking in at least $1.24 billion in taxpayer-funded subsidies and incentives that have fueled the company's growth across the country. That figure does not include hundreds of millions of dollars in additional breaks from deals to phase in state sales taxes, nor does it include dozens of hard-to-quantify tax abatements and land arrangements struck with a mosaic of towns, counties, and school districts along the way. Those subsidies, aggregated in a Business Journal's analysis of public records and financial filings from across the United States, have helped support the expansion of Amazon's sprawling network of more than 257 sorting and distribution centers, a 141 million square foot portfolio of facilities that house hundreds of thousands of workers in 33 states. The company has millions more square feet in Class A office space, as well as a rapidly expanding portfolio of data centers managed by Amazon Web Services, Inc., arguably its fastest growing division, and a beneficiary of more than $229 million in known taxpayer subsidies. Competition and a degree of desperation have been key to Amazon's well-honed strategy for maximizing taxpayer support. For example, the company has proven shrewd at pitting states and communities against one another by leveraging the allure of new jobs and the cachet that comes with landing a major technology company. What Amazon delivers is usually something more mundane. Cities throughout the country's wilting industrial hubs have been particularly eager to step up to Amazon's demands, even though the company's quick-turn delivery model requires proximity to the one asset they all possess, customers. But the incentives keep coming, totaling around $100 million in South Carolina, more than $127 million in Ohio, and millions more in the neighboring Rust Belt and coal country states of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Kentucky, and Illinois. Never mind that Amazon's massive fulfillment centers are accelerating the company's disruption of retail markets, or that what it often provides in return for taxpayer subsidies are low-wage warehouse functions that, by the company's own admission, are likely to be replaced by robots someday. It's all happening with the full-throated, and in some cases high-living, support of local officials. Interviews by the business journals with dozens of public officials and reviews of documents received through public records requests have turned up little in the form of skepticism or concerns voiced by community leaders when Amazon comes to town. Few have asked whether subsidizing Amazon's expansion is worth the cost, or how a company with around $30 billion in cash can possibly have a need for funding, as it was phrased in a recent subsidy application in Michigan. Instead, the business journals found examples in which elected officials waived wage requirements to enable Amazon to qualify for a particular subsidy or incentive plan. Their rationale, repeated by local officials interviewed by the business journals, any job is better than no job. Those dynamics will be on full display in the weeks ahead as the Seattle-based company seeks bids from U.S. cities to house HQ2, a proposed second North American headquarters expected to host up to 50,000 workers. Analysts suggest the winning bid will require billions of dollars in pledges of taxpayer support. Cities are lining up to throw a hat into the ring. Few would wager that HQ2 represents an endgame for the 53-year-old Bezos, or that his charges into e-commerce, rocket ships, groceries, publishing, and political lobbying in Washington, D.C. will satisfy what appears to be an insatiable appetite for growth. The Bezos juggernaut has always been something of a work in progress, where the possibilities for new products and customers are endless. It's a mastery for disruption that has spread to all corners of the U.S. economy and sent a shot across the bow of entire industries and regulators alike. What comes next could very well affirm or suffocate the notion of the American dream. Now, the second order article is entitled, How Big Incentives Can Lure a Giant? But before I read that, let me explain this graph that's at the bottom of the page, and in which they plot Amazon versus other retailers. And it's Amazon versus Walmart, Costco, Best Buy, Target, and Kroger. So here we are with Amazon with $25.9 billion in cash, Walmart with $6.86 billion, Costco with $4.73 billion, Best Buy with $3.9 billion, Target with $2.5 billion, and Kroger with $0.32 billion. Now, the other data presented in this graph is net income. And once again, we'll start with Amazon. $2.376 billion for Amazon. Once again, net income. Walmart, $13.456 billion. Costco with $2.350 billion. Best Buy with $1.148 billion. Target with about $2.9 billion. And Kroger with $2.05 billion. Now for the article. How Big Incentives Can Lure a Giant. Baltimore was desperate for jobs in 2013. An empty General Motors plant, once the heart of a thriving industrial complex, had become a city symbol of all the city had lost. Then the rumors started. Someone was interested in leasing the plant. The secretive development had a code name, Project Chesapeake, and could eventually bring as many as 2,600 jobs. Many guessed it was Amazon, but no one was talking. Behind closed doors, negotiators pushed for steep tax breaks. The company, they cautioned, was considering other locations. Martin O'Malley, then the governor of Maryland, stepped in to beef up the deal. In the end, Project Chesapeake received $40 million in tax breaks. Amazon has perfected this formula. Enter quietly, move fast, pit sites against each other, and used it to elicit more than $1.24 billion in subsidies from state and local governments to help build out a massive U.S. fulfillment and delivery network. Dozens of cities across the country report similar stories of secret, high-pressure negotiations. In some cases, Amazon's entry can be transformational for a struggling area. In others, officials are left with buyer's remorse when job totals fall short of expectations or when wages are so low they do little to buoy the local economy. Amazon declined to verify the Business Journal's research, but said it had an average of 3,600 jobs per county in 44 counties last year, which helped create a total of 100,000 additional indirect jobs in rural areas. The company said there were redundancies and incorrect job totals in the Business Journal's list of properties, but declined to provide specifics. The company, led by billionaire founder and CEO Jeff Bezos, relies on its cachet as a technology powerhouse to convince politicians it's bringing lucrative jobs to town. Meanwhile, Amazon scientists work tirelessly to replace workers with robots. Through its fulfillment center expansion, Amazon has maximized the spectrum of subsidies offered by cities and states. The company, and Bezos himself, puts a premium on secrecy when negotiating with local officials, and often asked to be notified when public information requests are made concerning its projects. It's also not uncommon to see specifics on its projects redacted from public documents outlining its local incentive agreements. Now, Amazon can use that same formula as it seeks a second headquarters. The company's request for proposals for HQ2, with its promise of up to 50,000 jobs and $5 billion in investment, outline the best ways to present Amazon with subsidies and incentives. Cities are falling over themselves to entice the Seattle company to town. Along with this article comes a map of the United States talking about where Amazon is located in America. And there are four different types of facilities. There's a fulfillment center where customer orders are picked, packed, and shipped. There are sortation centers. Now, these are located near fulfillment centers. These warehouses sort filled orders into zip codes for shipment. There are data centers. That's part of Amazon's fast-growing AWS division. Data centers have been a major recipient of taxpayer subsidies for the company. And then there's the Prime Air Hub, the company's portfolio of sorting and distribution warehouses located on site at a growing number of airports nationally. Since 2011, Amazon has quadrupled its number of fulfillment centers, most of which it leases. The company's on track to have 127 sites open by year-end, compared with 32 in 2019. Combined with its network of smaller sorting and delivery warehouses, Amazon will have roughly 150 million square feet of logistics space when current and planned facilities come online. And I suspect you probably know that Raleigh-Durham is home to a couple of these. Raleigh has an Amazon Prime Now warehouse. Durham has a sortation center. And there are about 8 or 10 other centers scattered around the United States. Troutdale, Oregon, San Bernardino, California, Aurora, Colorado, Thornton, Colorado, Shakopee, Minnesota, Coppell, Texas, Jacksonville, Florida. Of course, our own at Raleigh-Durham. The Fall River, Massachusetts Project Kayak, the Northeast Maryland Project Iron, and finally Kenosha, Wisconsin. And these are the major centers of these four types mentioned in the article. Now, back to the article. Replacing retailers. Amazon opened 26 fulfillment centers worldwide in 2016 and plans to bring at least that many more online by the end of this year. On average, a fulfillment center can open within 12 months of a lease signing if everything goes according to plan, Amazon spokeswoman Ashley Robinson said. As it expands, the company is positioning facilities closer and closer to large metro areas to speed up delivery, Robinson said. Meanwhile, Amazon's ruthlessly efficient network undercuts local retailers. Malls around the country are disappearing as department stores collapse. The retail industry has shed 87,000 jobs this year, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and companies from Toys R Us to Payless Source, Shoe Source to Radio Shack have filed for bankruptcy protection to reorganize. Amazon is rushing to fill the gap it helped create. In August, the company said it will lease a fulfillment center under construction on a failed mall property in Ohio. It was a rare case in which Amazon opted to lease a former retail space rather than a traditional logistics facility. Later that month, Amazon closed a deal to buy Whole Foods Market for $13.7 billion. Amazon has quickly grown into one of the world's largest companies, nearly tripling annual revenue to $136 billion during the past 5 years, and more than quadrupling its headcount to 382,000 during that same period. While the company promises thousands of jobs in each of its new fulfillment centers, Amazon has made clear its intention to automate many of its job functions. Amazon even hosts an annual robotics competition, with researchers from around the world vying to develop robots that will soon be able to pick up items and package orders. Baltimore's bid paid off. Project Chesapeake spurred redevelopment of an industrial park. Amazon now employs 3,500 people in Maryland and is finalizing plans for a third fulfillment center in Baltimore County that could net another $16 million in incentives and tax breaks. In other cities, the benefits weren't so clear. The Miami-Dade County Commissioner in Florida approved $1.5 million in tax rebate incentives and a $5 million bond for infrastructure improvements to entice Amazon to build a fulfillment center. Amazon secured an exemption for this facility so it won't have to pay warehouse workers, quote, responsible wages, unquote, a minimum pay threshold as defined by the county, for projects that receive taxpayer-funded bonds. Negotiations were a roller coaster ride that left local officials scrambling, one participant said. Amazon wanted the facility up and running for the 2018 holiday season, said James Cornstam, Senior Vice President of Economic Development at the Miami-Dade Beacon Council, and tried to get officials to break with convention and put everything into one resolution to expedite approval. They were saying, in other communities, we've gotten this done same day. So, Miami, what can you do? He said. Cornstam said he saw the group struggle to stay within protocol while making exceptions to appease Amazon. That transformed boardrooms into pressure cookers. Amazon hires real estate experts to evaluate a region and select a site long before these negotiations begin. Incentives for big companies like Amazon aren't always necessary to seal the deal, said Mark Williams, chairman of the Site Selectors Guild, an exclusive group of the world's top facility scouts. You can get great incentives at a terrible site with a terrible labor force and just make a terrible mistake, Williams said. However, if there are two sites that are exactly the same and one offers more incentives than the other, then they're probably going to win. Miami-Dade Inspector General Mary Cagle believes the county may have conceded too much. If you're guaranteed that Amazon is coming one way or the other, you should be pushing for a good deal, she said. Originally, the business park was expected to create 2,300 full-time jobs. Commissioners later scaled back the number of jobs necessary to qualify for the bond to 1,000. Minimum salary requirements were also cut from an average of $37,000 a year to $24,018 with benefits and $27,500 without benefits. This started out with language like game-changing, Cagle said. You have to ask yourself the question, is this game-changing? Even when a state has protections in place to prevent incentives going to companies that create low-paying jobs, Amazon still manages to get concessions. Project Rio outside Denver didn't receive state subsidies because Amazon's proposed wages fell short of Colorado standards for incentives. But leaders in the city of Thornton, where the project is underway, amended the city code to allow for 24-hour construction to meet Amazon's aggressive 16-month timeline. The Michigan Economic Development Corporation awarded Amazon a $7.5 million grant to help recruit employees for a new fulfillment center. The funding was meant to ensure the project didn't go to Indiana or Ohio, according to a state document outlining Amazon's application for the grant. The application, said Amazon, quote, demonstrated a need for funding, unquote. Amazon has already automated warehouse work once performed by humans. The company acquired Kiva Systems, later named Amazon Robotics, in 2012 for $775 million and has since filled its warehouses with fleets of small orange robots. More than 100,000 robots move product in about 25 of the company's fulfillment centers. The Roomba-like robots scurry like beetles underneath shelves of inventory, shuttling them to picking stations. There, workers pluck orders from the shelves and place them in totes that are spirited off to a conveyor belt to be packaged and shipped. The robots mean workers don't have to walk up and down aisles, leaving them more time to pick orders. In the heavily roboticized warehouses, Amazon has shrunk the aisles so much that humans can no longer traverse them. While it may seem like the robots are eliminating jobs, in some cases the increased efficiency has required more human workers to pick, pack, and ship the higher volumes of products. Those picker jobs, though, are also set to be automated. Amazon has plenty of motivation to automate its 125,000 warehouse jobs. Robots can work day and night without breaks and without labor standards. Modern robots can even learn and improve the more they do their jobs. There are certain types of jobs that we can make a strong argument for automating, said University of Washington Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Engineering Maya Kakmak. Fulfillment center jobs typically involve intense manual labor and shifts that last up to 12 hours. Breaks are minimal, and employees typically earn less than $30,000 per year. Picker bots could take over the most taxing of these jobs, Kakmak said, and that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. Amazon recently applied to patent robots that pick items directly from warehouse shelves and transfer them to mobile robot containers that whisk them off for packaging. Other patents envision urban high-rise fulfillment centers inside which robots prepare orders and hand them off in flying drones for delivery. Nearly 25 million jobs will be lost to automation over the next 10 years. According to the research firm Forrester, although the development and maintenance of smart warehouse bots will create 15 million jobs. Picker bots aren't commercially available yet, but could start showing up in Amazon warehouses in the next few years, said University of Washington Assistant Professor of Computer Science and Engineering and Electrical Engineering Joshua Smith. My guess is there will be people involved, Smith said, but it will change the way the people and robots work together. Amazon's already started planning for a future of fewer low-skill warehouse workers. The company offers regular full-time employees access to its career choice program, which prepays up to 95% of tuition for courses related to high-demand fields. Located near the entrances of fulfillment centers, career choice classrooms are the first thing employees see when they walk in and the last thing they see when they walk out. That, along with higher wages than other warehouse jobs, is what has attracted workers to Amazon. In Kent, Washington, about 20 miles south of Amazon's Seattle headquarters, hopeful prospects lined up, waiting to go through the screening process. Home prices have increased dramatically in the region, thanks in large part to the influx of Amazon's technology workers. As a result, a family making less than $72,000 qualifies for housing assistance. Even with 25 years of retail management experience, Davies estimated the Amazon job he was going for would pay about $45,000 per year. About as low as you can go to still afford to live in Amazon's backyard, he said. And finally, the third of these three articles about the Amazon effect is subtitled Influence on K Street, or Mr. Bezos Goes to Washington. Amazon.com, Inc. is quietly building a significant base of influence and voice in the nation's capital to boost its fast-expanding empire. The company cracked the top 20 lobbying spenders last year for the first time ever, and it's in the top 20 again this year to date. The only other major tech brand to do so in both years was Alphabet, Inc., the parent of Google, Inc. It's actually unusual to see a new company kind of come out of nowhere and break into that top 20 list, said Daniel Obel, senior researcher at the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics, which tracks lobbying spending. If you look back through the years, it's pretty consistently the same groups. It's all part of a strategy to wield a louder voice in the nation's hall of power, including upping its political donations and selling more than $1 billion worth of cloud services to the federal government. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos also bought the venerable Washington Post in 2013 and has set about to make it one of the most widely read digital publications in the world. Data show Amazon has spent $6.23 million on lobbying as of August 7th. That puts it on pace to rival its 2016 spending of $11.35 million, a 130% spike from 2 years prior, and a record-setting amount for Amazon. Since 2000, the company's lobbying has multiplied by a factor of 23. So far this year, it's used 77 lobbyists, including professionals at Squire Patton Boggs, Akin Gump, Ballard Partners, McGuire Woods, Brownstein Hyatt, Capital Tax Partners, and Monument Policy Group. 10 years ago, it reported using 23 lobbyists. "Look at the list of firms they've under contract to," said Stephen Billett, director of the Legislative Affairs Master's Degree Program at George Washington University. "I mean, it's an A-list. These are pretty effective outfits, all of which have some great reputations in town." Billett, who spent years working as a lobbyist for AT&T before becoming chief of staff at GWU's Graduate School of Political Management, also pointed out that Amazon's in-house government affairs team has grown exponentially as well, from 2 employees 10 years ago to 21 today. "That's significant," he said. So what issues are on the company's radar? Amazon has filed the most lobbying reports this year, 17 in all, on tax issues, making it the 12th most frequent lobbyist on that topic. It's also filed 4 on financial regulation. A key example, the Financial Choice Act of 2017, which would impose sweeping changes on the financial regulatory system, including the reversal of key components in the Dodd-Frank Act. Amazon is especially interested in how the bill would affect mobile payment systems and cybersecurity. Another is the Remote Transactions Parity Act in the House, and a similar bill in the Senate, which would essentially require online retailers to collect sales taxes in all states, regardless of whether they have a physical presence there. Amazon separately has a big stake in influencing antitrust legislation. In the wake of the company's June announcement that it would buy grocery store chain Whole Foods, the online retail giant bought on Renata Hess and Thomas Barnett as consultants to help navigate the inevitable wave of antitrust scrutiny. The pair served as heads of the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, Hess in the last year of President Barack Obama's administration, Barnett from 2005 to 2008 under President George W. Bush. The gambit worked, as the government signed off on the union relatively swiftly. What's striking about Amazon's efforts? The sheer variety of bills that get its attention. Amazon's lobbying has swung from legislation governing postal rates to those affecting its ability to operate drones to deliver packages. Microsoft, a long time ago, used to tell people they were above politics and they had a minuscule Washington, D.C. presence, Billett said. And then there was an antitrust suit and they got whacked. And the lesson from that was they didn't have any friends in this town. Because they didn't make any friends, they had a small, insignificant government affairs operation that hasn't been lost on the tech sector since. While it's difficult to say how successful Amazon's vast lobbying efforts have been, public reports don't specify which side of an issue any lobbying client falls, we do know which bills have caught its attention and the fate of so far of each. In the case of the internet taxation bills, versions of the bill have stalled in 3 state congressional sessions. "Oftentimes, you're most successful when nothing happens," Billett said. "Sometimes you're successful because you built a network. You made the contacts. The people who might do harm to you always call you before they think about really doing it." I think really good lobbyists and really effective lobbying organizations anticipate a lot of the trouble that may take place, and if they're doing their job, they're out there preventing some of that activity. Some of the best lobbying I ever did were bills that never got introduced. While the company has long worked to avoid internet taxes by strategically locating facilities and advocating against such measures, It announced this year that it's collecting taxes on all its own sales in all states and D.C. It does not collect sales taxes for third parties that sell on its site. But Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the D.C.-based Institute for Local Self-Reliance, a nonprofit that advocates for equitable community development and has opposed Amazon's approach in the past, isn't convinced. She said Amazon's recent advocacy of the online sales tax smells of a ruse that garners positive press, while the company tacitly seeks to undermine any legislation that would level those taxes. They've ostensibly been in favor of a federal internet sales tax bill, but they're actually used their, quote, support to torpedo it in various ways, she said. My read on it is, being in support sort of got them to the table in a way that allowed them to raise issues that ultimately actually blocked the bill's passage. Along with this article is a very large graph showing Amazon lobbying spending since the year 2000. And I won't read all of these data to you, except to point out that in 2000, the amount that Amazon spent on lobbying was $492,000. In 2012, that amount had grown to $2.5 million. 2 years later, 2014, that was $4.9 million. In 2015, that was $9.4 million. In 2016, $11.4 million. And this year, so far, as of August the 7th at least, $6.23 million. So it's on pace to rival Amazon's record spending from 2016. Now, from this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the first article called, Where Can You Find the Best Quality of Life? Obviously, that's one of the issues that was a big piece of the Amazon bid for the RFP that I believe closed this past week. And this was a study by NerdWallet. NerdWallet studied 177 U.S. cities with more than 150,000 residents using data from the U.S. Census Bureau's 2016 American Community Survey to determine the places with the best quality of life. And people in Madison, Wisconsin are living the good life. That city ranked number one on NerdWallet's list of best cities for quality of life for its high number of residents with health insurance, low unemployment numbers, and an average 20-minute workday commute. NerdWallet studied 177 U.S. cities with more than 150,000 residents, and here are the other nine cities. Obviously, Madison, Wisconsin was number one. So, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Lincoln, Nebraska at number three, Overland Park, Kansas at four, Boise, Idaho at five, and at number six, our very own Cary, North Carolina. At seven, Eugene, Oregon, Little Rock, Arkansas at eight, Des Moines, Iowa at 9, and finally 10, Scottsdale, Arizona. Quality of life is subjective and regularly fluctuates, Forbes reported, but it often relies on social relationships, employment, housing, and wealth, among other factors. U.S. News & World Report described Madison, Wisconsin, number 18 on its list of best places to live, as a hotbed of the healthcare, information technology, and manufacturing industries that has steadily welcomed new residents over the past decade and is growing to accommodate and entertain these transplants. Now, here come a lot of numbers. The 252,557 residents in Madison, Wisconsin work an average of 37 hours a week. 39% of their monthly income goes toward rent, according to NerdWallet. Sioux Falls, South Dakota, has an unemployment rate of 2.6%, tied with McKinney, Texas, for the lowest in NerdWallet's study. Median gross rent takes up 27% of residents' monthly income, making it the third most affordable city behind Cary, North Carolina at 25.4%, and Frisco, Texas at 23.7%. Newark, New Jersey ranked last in quality of life. The average commute in the city is about 35 minutes, and rent takes up 47.6% of residents' monthly income. And while we're talking about lifestyle and quality of life, let's explore the area of food and lifestyle with the article, Former White Street Head Brewer Starts New Brewery in Raleigh. Ian Van Gundy is the head brewer for Raleigh's newest brewery, 1323 R&D. A new brewery is coming to Raleigh, but don't expect to pull up a seat at the bar anytime soon, because there won't be a tap room, at least for its first year. A group of diverse beer industry enthusiasts have created 1323 R&D, which is experimenting with new recipes and ideas that will be hitting local bars in the next few weeks. The brewery is led by former Lone Rider and Wheat Street brewer Ian Van Gundy, and a group of five others who have worked with local distributor R.A. Jeffries. Van Gundy has received many accolades in the brewing industry during his past two endeavors, including gold medals in the World Beer Cup, Great American Beer Festival, and the U.S. Open Beer Championship. He was also recognized as one of the 30 under 30 brewers in the country back in 2013 by All About Beer magazine. The team covers a few different demographics and diversities, Van Gundy says. We're not just a group of dudes looking for the next beer hype. The brewery recently sold its first kegs to Parkside Restaurant in downtown Raleigh. The beer will soon be in other local restaurants and bottle shops, including Bottle Rev, Bottle Mix, and the Hop Yard. The operation is starting small with a 3.5-barrel system situated in locally, roughly 7,000 square feet of brewing space they own off Capitol Boulevard. The group hopes to grow it into something larger in the future. We've already talked about upgrading, Van Gundy says. We could go up to a 10-barrel system. I'm really good at double batching and can do 20 barrels in a day. As for now, the brewery is starting off with a line of possible flagship beers, which will include IPAs featuring a variety of single hops such as Citra, Mosaic, Calypso, and El Dorado, as well as a collection of lagers. Van Gundy says the group doesn't want to be a brewery with a special niche. They just want to get their product out there and make a perfect beer. We're looking to get customer feedback so that when we're ready to can or bottle, we're perfecting our beer rather than can and then learn, he says. Van Gundy got his start at the Siebel Institute in Chicago before eventually landing his first endeavor in the industry working at American Brewmaster Homebrew Supply Store in Raleigh. He was actually offered a job at a store prior to his 21st birthday, and he had to wait 3 months before he could start working. This area back then really didn't have a scene, so it was a lot of the homebrewers who made a scene, he says. Several former American Brewmaster employees have landed jobs as brewers in Raleigh, such as Don Federal of Raleigh Brewing Company and Thomas Vincent of Natty Greens and Compass Rose. Now we move from talking about brewing to food. And this article is entitled Following in Her Family's Fast Food Footsteps. And it details Emily Castleman. Castleman became the owner and operator of a McDonald's restaurant in Eminence, Kentucky in August. She's one of 810 women franchises in the United States. Emily Castleman grew up watching her father, George Saliba, operate seven McDonald's restaurants in Northern Kentucky. In August, she became the owner-operator of a restaurant in Eminence, Kentucky, starting her own McDonald's legacy. After graduating from Kentucky University in 2007, Castleman landed a job as North America Recruiting Specialist for Product Supply Engineering at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 2012, Castleman returned to Kentucky to prepare to become a franchisee. She joined a company training program for second-generation owner-operators and became a supervisor at several of her dad's restaurants. Castleman still manages two of those restaurants, in addition to running her own. Castleman, age 34, is one of the more than 800 women who are McDonald's franchisees in the United States. McDonald's is committed to increasing the number of minority and women operators, and to the best of our knowledge, has the single largest group of minority and women operators in our industry, the company said in a statement. Additionally, the McDonald's internal network of women franchisees is dedicated to nurturing talent, developing leaders, and recognizing achievements. Castleman is part of her local chapter of the McDonald's Women Operator Network, which she said provides support and advocates for women's financial success and growth in leadership positions. So they asked her a question, and that was, how does your experience at Procter & Gamble influence your work at McDonald's? My time at the Procter & Gamble Company was just incredibly valuable for what I do today. It taught me a lot about talking to people, people with different experience. What's important to people in a job? My full-time job was a recruiter. That's what it really is about now, giving opportunity to people in our company so they can ultimately serve our guests every day. Now moving from food and drink to technology. AI's emotional awareness is growing. Emotion, artificial intelligence technology, has potential applications in many areas of everyday life, such as healthcare, automotive transportation, and education. The co-founder of an emotion artificial intelligence company said she expects the technology that surrounds us in our everyday lives to become emotion aware in the next 5 years, making our tech interactions more personalized. Rana El Kaloubi, CEO and co-founder of Avactiva, said her company will use computer vision, speech analysis, and deep learning to study 6 million face videos collected in 87 countries and develop algorithms that can identify emotions such as happiness, sadness, anger, as well as complex cognitive states such as fatigue, attention, interest, confusion, and distraction. She said younger generations are losing their ability to empathize because they're growing up with digital interfaces that lack emotion. Technology that feels empathy and responds to human emotions could have a positive effect on combating that deficiency. Emotion artificial intelligence technology has potential applications in many areas of everyday life, such as healthcare, automotive transportation, and education. In the healthcare arena, emotion AI could be used to recognize feelings that signal suicidal tendencies, or to provide support for people with autism, who often have difficulty expressing and recognizing human emotions. Automobiles could be designed to recognize impatience and anger in their drivers and respond by changing ergonomic and environmental factors, such as the position of the driver's seat or the music that's playing, to soothe negative feelings. Personalized education programs could tailor their teaching methods to what a student's emotions express, maybe restating a question in a different way if they sense that a student is confused or frustrated. At the New Scientist Live Expo in September, Avactiva's co-founder, Rosalind Picard, said the goal of emotion artificial intelligence should be making lives better, not just developing the smartest machine. Picard and her team have focused on developing wireless wearable devices that monitor the nervous system through the skin, gathering biological information that correlates with emotions. Also in this week's Triangle Business Journal in the technology page comes the article, Citrix Sues Former Raleigh Employees Over Non-Compete Clause. Jessica Bell was 2.5 years into her tenure as a sales engineer at Citrix in Raleigh when whispers of layoffs had her brushing up her resume. As a single mom, it's very important to me to be able to take care of my child, she said Thursday in an interview. I can't afford to be out of work, so I was definitely looking to find other opportunities, employment elsewhere. When a recruiter from Silicon Valley-based Ignite, now I'll spell this, it's E-G-N-Y-T-E, so I think it's Ignite. So when a recruiter from Ignite called and told her about the new sales office the firm was opening in Raleigh, she said it was a perfect fit. As she gave her notice September 4th, however, that stack of papers she had signed when she started at Citrix would come back to haunt her. Weeks into her new job at Ignite, a letter was sent to her house telling her she was in violation of a non-compete clause. And she wasn't alone. When Ignite opened its 10-person Raleigh sales office, 7 of its new employees came from Citrix, the company said, and all 7 were issued threats by Citrix, said Rajesh Ram, co-founder of Ignite. It's perplexing that they go after employees who did a good job for them and dictate where they can and can't work, he said in an interview. We would rather fight this battle in the marketplace than in the courtroom. Anticipating that fight, Ignite filed a lawsuit in California on October the 6th, claiming Citrix's non-compete clauses are overly broad and asking the court to deem them to be unenforceable. 5 days later, Citrix fired back with a suit of its own, naming Ignite as well as the 7 former Citrix employees as defendants. That suit, filed in Florida, alleges that Ignite solicited its employees in order to engage in unfair competition with Citrix. In addition to accusing the defendants of breaching the non-compete agreements, Citrix accuses them of downloading multiple documents on their personal computers that contain trade secrets, even after the employment had ended. Those defendants, including Bell, deny wrongdoing. Ram insisted the employees were hired because they were great talent, not because they came from Citrix. "We have no interest in their IP," Ram said of Citrix. "We have no interest in their customer base. This is a very large customer market we serve. We built this company purely on the strength of our pipeline that we have a lot of faith in. We're happy to fight the battle on our own terms in terms of winning customers." Ignite, not the seven employees, will foot the full legal bill, Ram pledged. As for Citrix, a spokeswoman said the firm has declined to comment on the pending litigation and referred Triangle Business Journal to a memorandum it had filed in support of its case. In the document, the firm accuses Ignite of poaching employees to help Ignite launch a new office in Citrix's backyard. Not only did these new Ignite employees come with valuable insight gained over the years they spent at Citrix, several of these employees raided Citrix's confidential customer files, taking hundreds of confidential and highly sensitive sales and technical documents with them, according to the memo filed October the 16th. Citrix's reasonable 12-month non-competition agreement, signed by each of the individual defendants, was designed to avoid exactly this kind of behavior and prevent exactly this kind of injury to Citrix. On October 16th, Citrix filed an emergency temporary restraining order and injunction on the defendants, requesting that they be forced to stop working for Ignite immediately. Bell admitted there was a stack of paperwork to go through when she took the job at Citrix, but said she didn't understand the scope of what she had signed. "I certainly didn't think this would have implications and that they would have any control or power over my ability to feed my family, after I left Citrix," she said. The layoffs Citrix recently disclosed validate her decision to seek employment elsewhere, she added. Ignite CEO Vineet Jain released a statement Friday accusing Citrix of resorting to legal maneuvering in order to prevent their former employees from obtaining gainful employment with Ignite. Jain said that Ignite offered to work with Citrix to ensure that its information was protected, but alleged that Citrix refused. "This indicates to us that Citrix is not trying to protect any of its intellectual property, but rather is trying to punitively attack its former employees who have been terminated or have seen the writing on the wall and are leaving before they get laid off," he stated. L. Diane Tindall, an attorney with Raleigh's Wyrick, Robbins, Yates, and Ponton, has no connection to the case, but says where the cases were filed, choice of law could play into the outcome. While North Carolina doesn't have a statute addressing competition clauses, both California and Florida do. In California, where Ignite filed its suit, they're absolutely unenforceable, while in Florida, where Citrix filed its complaint, they can be. When two competing state doctrines are employed, it can go either way. She cautions employees to read documentation carefully before they sign anything, even if they think a non-compete is unenforceable. They can go after you, and you might win in the long run, but it might cost you a lot of money to defend yourself, she says. Now in this week's TBJ's Commercial Real Estate comes the article, Dominion Outlines Timeline for 22-Story Downtown Raleigh Tower. In 2018, the downtown Raleigh skyline changes forever as a 22-story office tower breaks ground, Charter Square North. Already, F&B Corporation has signed on as an anchor tenant. Dominion Realty CEO Andy Andrews says conversations with additional tenants for the $110 million building are well underway. While Andrews had initially said a groundbreaking could happen in December, the target is now February. Deliveries expected in 2019. "We've been finalizing our drawings and pricing. We're right on schedule," he says. "We're locking up our partners." The building, which includes 156,000 square feet of office space and 239 apartment units, unveiled an anchor tenant in Pennsylvania-based First National Bank parent F&B Corporation, which closed on its buy of Raleigh's Yadkin Financial earlier this year. The bank is taking about 40,000 square feet of space. Dominion 2 will be a tenant. The tower is already 50% pre-leased. "And we're negotiating with some folks right now," Andrew said. In the meantime, the Dominion team has had plenty to occupy itself with in 2017. This month, the company broke ground on the $50 million Whitehall Village Apartments in Charlotte. The four-story Wade 4 in Raleigh has its grand opening in November, having already named SageWorks as a tenant. And Dominion is breaking ground on Crabtree Lakeside, a 220-unit apartment complex between behind Raleigh's Crabtree Mall in December. And in other retail business comes the article, Walmart partners with Lord & Taylor. Walmart is close to a deal with department store Lord & Taylor in its latest move to take on Amazon, according to the Wall Street Journal. The partnership would be the first step in creating an online mall that would be accessible from Walmart's website, per the Wall Street Journal. Men's clothing brand Bonobos and online retailer Jet.com, both owned by Walmart, could also be added to the project in the future. For now, Lord & Taylor will continue to run its own website, but shoppers will be able to pick up and return items at Walmart's U.S. stores. Amazon has pushed in recent years to win over fashion brands, scoring deals with Nike, Calvin Klein, Kate Spade, and Levi Strauss. Amazon has also boosted its presence in physical stores after making deals with Whole Foods and Kohl's. Walmart's rapidly grown its online business, Axios reports, and has convinced investors that it can take on Amazon in the battle to dominate American e-commerce. This year, Walmart acquired several retail brands such as Moose Jaw, Bonobos, and ShoeBuy, and recently hired former Saks executive Denise Incandela to lead its fashion business for the U.S. e-commerce division, Fortune reported. During a recent Investor Day presentation, Walmart promised 40% growth in e-commerce sales by January 2019, and Walmart stock rose 4.5% the following morning, according to Axios. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long till next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that's 919-832-5138. 3-8.